SiriusXM presents Stanford Pathfinders.
Stanford has 225,000 alumni living all over the globe in 151 countries, and they're some of the most amazing people you would ever want to meet.
A show about how the graduates of Stanford University are changing our lives and the world.
We'll hear very interesting things from business leaders in the technology sector, but well beyond that, the worlds of politics, entertainment, business, and beyond.
Inspiring stories from America's innovation heartland.
It's a place where people look to the future, not to the past, where they don't rest on their laurels. Think about the gold rush. Think about Stanford being formed in the late 1800s. And then Stanford was the beginning of Silicon Valley. And the ethos of Silicon Valley is deeply embedded in the Stanford spirit. It's a spirit of innovation, experimentation. It's a spirit of being willing to try new things and risk failure as long as you fail forward.
Welcome to Stanford Pathfinders.
A two-time alum of Stanford University with an undergraduate degree and a graduate degree from the Graduate School of Education of Policy Organization and Leadership Studies.
I remember moving in feeling really nervous, but by the time I left, and to this day, it's like a second home to me.
The youngest and first African-American mayor of Stockton, California.
You know, I'm going to take that same entrepreneurial mindset, that same Silicon Valley innovation, but apply it to like really complexing social issues and problems that actually need to be solved for our existence.
This week on Stanford Pathfinders, Michael Tubbs. Now here's your host, Howard Wolf.
These are challenging times for our nation as we try to get our collective heads around why racism, and in particular anti-Black racism, continues to exist more than 150 years after the ratification of the 13th Amendment ending slavery. There are many debates that have emerged on this topic in the spring of 2020. Is racism structural and systemic in society, or instead does it only manifest itself on a personal level? Is racism less prevalent today than it was in 1964 before the Civil Rights Act was ratified, or is it more prevalent? And perhaps most importantly, will the protests and conversations catalyzed by George Floyd ultimately make a material difference in the nature of racism in America in the future? The debates are many, but one thing is not open to debate. If racism is to be addressed in America today, it must be addressed at the municipal city level, as well as all governmental levels. And today's guest on Stanford Pathfinder says much to stay on this topic. Michael Tubbs holds 2 degrees from Stanford and is the mayor of Stockton, California. Stockton has a highly diverse population of more than 300,000 citizens and lies in California's robust Central Valley. And as Stockton's youngest ever mayor and first Black mayor, Mayor Tubbs is making many waves in the city in which he was raised. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, so I love to start each show with the same question for Stanford folks, and that is, what's your Stanford story? Where were you living when you applied to Stanford? Why did you choose to attend Stanford? What's your favorite memory? You know the drill. Why was Stanford so special?
My Stanford story, I was living in my old council district in the south part of the city. I had just been rejected a week before from Duke University, and I thought that was a foreboding action. I got the email or the letter from Dean Shaw. So I was like, well, if I didn't get into Duke, then of course I didn't get into Stanford. So I remember very nervously getting the envelope and trying to figure out if I was to open it. And I worked at Barnes & Noble at the time. So I remember reading the first line, it said, congratulations. And I still don't think I've read the complete letter yet. I just ran out the house crying and yelling, yeah. Called my mom, my aunt at work. They were crying. Then I went to work at Barnes & Noble. And I will never forget, my manager didn't believe me.
You didn't believe me?
She was like, she didn't believe me. I said, I got into Stanford. She's like, no way, you're lying. So I had to go print out the email for her to see. And then at Stanford, I lived in Ujamaa for 3 years, amazing. I met my wife at Stanford, planning a protest around racism in the criminal justice system. So Stanford is just, I remember moving in and feeling really nervous, but by the time I left, and to this day, it's like a second home to me. It's like Stockton, Stanford, those are my places.
And you made a big impact at Stanford while you were there, but you talked about Stockton, so let's talk a little bit about your story as a child, because that's deeply affected your time both at Stanford and as a politician. So tell us your story and why is it so important for listeners to know your personal background as it informs your life today?
Yeah. Well, I was born and raised in Stockton, Stockton's home. So I get to be the mayor of the city I was literally born in, which is awesome. Growing up, my mom, she had me really young. She had me as a high schooler. My father, he was a high schooler as well, but he was in a juvenile detention facility when I was born. So growing up, a lot of the issues are coming to the surface, particularly during this time with the anger over the George Floyd killing and with the COVID-19 crisis exacerbating or highlighting discrepancies or things I experienced growing up. So poverty, education as opportunity, police community relations, all those things were things I felt viscerally before I studied them at Stanford and before I began to work on them as mayor. While at Stanford, I was really passionate about the opportunity structure and how do I make it so that my story is not so unique, but that the kids I grew up with, the kids in my city and kids throughout this country would have opportunity to show how smart they were, how much potential they had, and how they were with, how much richer our communities, our schools, our cities are when they're given every opportunity that, that other kids are afforded. And then while at Stanford, one of my cousins, I was literally interning in the White House when one of my cousins was a victim of a homicide in Stockton. Oh. And it was really that homicide that caused me to go back and run for city council during my senior year. Because again, I spent my time at Stanford reflecting a lot about kind of not just the bad things, but the great things I learned from the city, resilience, appreciation of diversity as the most diverse state. Real family values, community values, but also reflected on sort of the not so great parts, like the achievement levels of the school I went to, or the discrepancies between zip codes, where I lived in high school actually has a 6-year difference in life expectancy than where I live now near the University of the Pacific in the same city. And those places are only 10 minutes away. And Stanford gave me a chance to reflect on those things. But when my cousin was murdered, I decided, you know what, I actually want to work on these things and put this education and this privilege to good use. So I wouldn't just get scholarships for being from Stockton, but I'll actually do my best to change some of the things I wrote about.
All right, as you just mentioned, though, you actually started your campaign while you were still at Stanford, right? And so you jumped into politics immediately upon graduation. You became a member of the city council, and then back in 2016, you were elected the youngest at 26 years of age, ridiculous, and the first Black mayor of Stockton. So what drew you to that political realm? Was it the desire to make change and seeing what happened in your city?
Yeah, I think when I ran for city council, the murder of my cousin, within that next year, we had even more homicides. We had more per capita in 2012 than Chicago, and we had just declared bankruptcy. And my entire family was in Stockton. I taught kids the summer before Stanford. All my kids were calling me every day while at Stanford complaining about Stockton or sharing some of their trauma. And I had a real feeling of survivor's guilt. And also I felt like kind of led to going back home. And I say that because I didn't want to go. I wasn't excited or happy or triumphant in going. I felt like a responsibility. Like, oh, I wasn't unhappy, but it wasn't this like grand plan. I just felt like a compulsion or a calling, if you will, to do that. So I decided to run. And then for 4 years as a city council member, I realized that government can't do everything, but government can do, at the very least, reverse the harms it has caused. And I saw that we were able to make a big difference in a part-time council job. And everyone kept treating me like the mayor and expecting me to do things in every council district. Or when business owners would come to the city, they would want to meet with the councilman. So I said, if you want to treat me like the mayor, I should be the mayor. So then I decided to run for mayor. And again, it's been 3.5 years, difficult. But last thing I'll say at this point, Howard, actually, is given the audience we're talking to in terms of Stanford people, I think for me, at Stanford, I was exposed to social entrepreneurship and being very entrepreneurial and innovative, and innovating outside of the system. But then I realized, particularly now in the seat I sit in, that part of the issue with government is if all the best and brightest are outside the system, are creating new systems, or are making a lot of money, then who does that leave to govern, right? So I figured I'm going to take that same entrepreneurial mindset, that same Silicon Valley innovation, but apply it to like really complexing social issues and problems that actually need to be solved for our existence. And that those are the kind of the reasons that drove me to the joys of local government.
So politics is not for the faint of heart, right? This is a tough, tough business. So what's been the biggest surprise or disappointment working in the field of politics that you didn't see coming?
The biggest surprise has been how much leadership matters. That just by having the respect of folks, like when you come into the room, the conversation changes by a question you ask, or the conversation changes because of an experience you had, or the conversation changes because you're in the room, and how a lot of these things aren't these super objective processes. That policymaking, for good and for, or for bad, I would argue mostly for bad, is very subjective to the whims and feelings of people, which means that people matter, and who the leaders are matters. The second thing that's been surprising is how you can do so much good, but if people don't know about it, it's like it hasn't happened. So one of my biggest frustrations have been, we've been striking on all cylinders on every issue that is important or emerging. We try to do something on it that's significant. And I've found out in the course of the past year in campaigning for re-election, a lot of people just didn't know.
They're just not paying attention.
So I'm also learning that it's important to do, and that's what I'm biased towards action, but it's also important to explain and to communicate. And I'm not the best at that, but I'm kind of building my staff's capacity to do that, because I realize a lot of people just don't understand what's moving, how things are moving, why things are better, and that's on us to explain it. So those are the two biggest things. Like, you have to over-communicate, and that leadership actually does matter. Like, it does matter who's in the room.
So let's dive a little deeper into Stockton. So you are reinventing the city of Stockton. So tell us a little bit about Stockton. What are its challenges? Where did you see the opportunities? And what are these things that we need to communicate better about the successes you've had to date?
Yeah, thank you. Stockton, California is about an hour and 20 minutes away from Stanford. In fact, many of my constituents commute over the hill. Some work at Stanford, some work at throughout the Bay Area. It's the most diverse city in this country. The oldest Sikh temple in North America is in Stockton. At one time, we had more Filipino people living in Stockton than any place in the world outside the Philippines.
Wow.
Dolores Huerta, Larry Itliong are from Stockton, and actually did a lot of the farm workers organizing in South Stockton, where I'm from. It's a community rich in history, but also with challenges. So when I came back to Norfolk City Council, we were the largest city at the time to declare bankruptcy. We had 72 homicides, more per capita than Chicago. We high levels of illiteracy, high levels of poverty, and we haven't solved all those problems, but we've made significant progress. So the last 2 years, we've had a 40% reduction in homicides from the 2017 number of 51, which is almost it's 100+% reduction in homicides from 2012, from 71 to 33. And that's significant because historically we've been double the state average for the past 30 years. And last year and the year before, and it's looking like this year, we're the only time in the entire decade that we have less than 40 homicides in back-to-back years, which shows that we're trending in the right direction.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm super proud of that. Even though one homicide is too many, 33 is a lot better than 55. So we'll use that as a new baseline. We are the second most fiscally healthy city in the state because of the bankruptcy. We just passed the budget now this year during COVID with no layoffs, no furloughs, no service cuts, and no deficit spending. And we met all our reserve targets, which I'm really proud of. We were named an All-American City 2 of the last 3 years I've been mayor. We started a program called Stockton Scholars, where every single kid from our largest school district, and this was inspired by my time at Stanford, is guaranteed a scholarship to a 4-year school, a 2-year school, or a trade school, meaning that once kids graduate, we're giving them real opportunity and letting them know the city believes that they're investing in them is the best investment we can make. And actually, the first initial $20 million from that, for that fund came from someone I met at Stanford, one of my dear friends, Evan Spiegel, who's now the CEO of SNAP. We're the first city in the country to pilot a basic income experiment, which is been expanded to January. And then today we announced I'm starting a group called Mayors for Guaranteed Income, where we have as of today, 12 other cities who are going to do pilots, including LA, Compton, Atlanta, Newark, New Jersey, St. Paul, Minnesota, Jackson, Mississippi. So now Stockton is moving from a place where people look for problems to a place that people look at for solutions. And I'm very proud of that.
All right, so let's turn to the times in which we live. And in particular, talk about the killing of George Floyd and the groundswell of support seemingly nationwide and around the world, racial justice and equity, particularly for Black citizens. And I'm just curious, so let's step away from Stockton and just think about yourself as a student of race and ethnicity and diversity and inclusion. Has the response that you've seen over the last month surprised you? And at the end of the day, do you think this, Harvard, you know, do you think this points to real change, or is this just an episodic thing?
No, and I hate to say this and to be so honest, but I am shocked. I am shocked. I am shocked. I am shocked in a good way. So I remember my whole college experience was spent, again, planning protests or demonstrations around the extrajudicial killing of Black people in this country. My beginning of my freshman, I think, winter quarter started with Oscar Grant being killed at the BART station. And feeling anger around that. By my senior year, it was Trayvon Martin, and when I was a fellow at the school, I went and protested with Stanford students on the US 101 for Michael Brown. And all those times, I felt the same level of anger and rage, and that things have to get better. And we hadn't seen the change that matched with the need. And this time just feels so much different, because it's not just because what's been. I'm hearing what's been said in the streets, echoed in the halls of power. I have conservative members, business owners, wealthy individuals in the community calling me saying, Mayor Tubbs, Black Lives Matter. Where's the Black Lives Matter agenda for Stockton? How can we support you? I have my police chief saying we have to keep making reforms. Like, we understand policing started with slave patrols and we have to change that. And I think it's been vindicating because I've been talking about the need to invest in other forms of safety, and that cops can be social workers or therapists or mental health workers or housing navigators for the homeless, and that the only response to neighborhoods like the one I grew up in cannot just be policing. Things like basic income now, you have mayors and other folks saying we need to consider this idea seriously. And so I do think that change isn't inevitable, but I do think it's likely because I feel like enough people are fed up. I joked to a group of friends not too long ago that if it was up to Black people to end like white supremacy or racial injustice, then it would have ended 400 years ago. There's never been a time where we're like, oh, it's fine. No. So I've been really heartened to see how many of all people, particularly white people, are saying, no, this is unacceptable. We have to do more. We have to demand more. We have to do better. And the last thing I would say, I think my only fear in this moment is that we make it just about policing, when I think policing is just symptomatic of deeper problems. I was told in the interview yesterday, and I said, well, this may be shocking to you, but there's not one institution in America that treats Black people as well as they treat white people. From nursery school, when Black kids are 50% more likely to be suspended than white kids at 3 years old, to banks in terms of the loans that are given, to even the fact that a Black person with a college degree makes less than a white person with a high school diploma. So it's not just about policing, it's a good entry point, but we have to really talk about all of our systems, all of our institutions, and how do we just make sure that we provide an equality of opportunity, and that we repair against some of the harms that government has created so that our world could be more reflective of the values we have, namely liberty, justice for all.
This is Stanford Pathfinders. I'm Howard Wolf. More with the mayor of Stockton, California, on the topic of politics and the fight for racial justice next on SiriusXM. This is Stanford Pathfinders. I'm Howard Wolf, and I'm speaking with Michael Tubbs, the mayor of Stockton, California, on the topic of politics and the fight for racial justice. There still seems to be this debate about not whether racism exists, because obviously it does, but whether it's systemic and institutional or if it's just, you know, person-to-person racism. Where do you come out on that debate?
I personally, as a policymaker, do not care about individual racism. I can't spend energy There's not a policy for that. Can't do it. But I do care if your individual racism is allowed to change the life outcomes for somebody else who's equally a citizen. And that's where I stand. So I think that, again, there's a book stamped from the beginning, but there's all literature that speaks to how in every institution in this country, like every institution, there is evidence of racial bias, racism, a history of exclusion that manifests today. And I think for a lot of people, it's hard to reckon with that because it means like the systems that have worked well for me, you, and your family may not work as well for right. other people. And then they also point to success stories. Well, look, Mayor Tubbs went to Stanford, or look, Barack Obama. And the fact that we point to success stories, to exceptionalism, suggests to me that subconsciously we know something systemic is wrong, where someone who went to Stanford becoming mayor is so noteworthy, or someone from a community like Stockton with a incarcerated parent, because there's a lot of kids in our country, sadly, that have parents who are incarcerated. A lot of Black kids in this country have parents who are incarcerated. So for one to make it to Stanford and become mayor, and that's noteworthy. What about the millions and millions and millions of other? We can't just explain that by individual choices. So to answer your question, I think a hard look at the data. If you look at the fact that the, again, like I said earlier, white folk with a high school diploma have more wealth than Black folks with college degrees. Black folks with college degrees make 70% of what white folks with high school diploma make. And these are people who made the right decisions, went to school, et cetera. If you look at kind of housing and the foreclosure crisis, it's no accident that Black folks were more likely to have a foreclosure during the subprime mortgage crisis, because they're also more likely to give subprime loans. They were more likely to be given subprime loans, which the banks and institutions knew they would eventually default on. Or if you look at the history of this country with the Homestead Act, where literally land was given to folks, but Black people, to settle land and to grow commerce. When you look at how Black folks were excluded from many of the New Deal programs, or how they were excluded from the GI Bill, it paints a picture that's really troubling, and I think everyone should be upset and embarrassed by it. But it also paints a picture for what needs to happen in terms of just making sure, at the very least, we look at all the ways in which government has institutionalized racism or racist thoughts, and how do we change that so that it's not going to happen overnight. It's been a 400-year question. But if we don't start today, it'll be even that much harder for the next generation. I think, to your point, everyone's just fed up. Everyone's like, it's going to take a lot of work, but we have to start somewhere. And that's the team I'm on. Let's start to continue to push and make our country what we know it can be.
Can there be racial justice in America without economic justice?
I don't think so. I just don't think in a capitalist society that it's there. I think part of racial justice has to be economic justice, because if you look at the beginnings of the racial injustice, it was economic. It was chattel slavery for hundreds of years, land theft before that, where folks were, where the American economy and industry was able to be built and become a superpower through hundreds of years of free labor with no union protections, no benefits, no payment for hundreds of years. There's no way we'll have justice without some level of economic justice. And then you compound that with like the legacy of sharecropping. You compound that with the legacy of mass incarceration today. There has to be some sort of economic justice as part of this conversation, which is why I think the basic income conversation is super important. Not as a panacea, but as a good step. I mean, Dr. King was talking about this before he died, and this idea that we want to pull people up by their bootstraps. We want people to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, but they have to have money for boots and for shoestrings, and in some places, money for a floor to put their boots down on.
And tell me a little bit about the basic income in Stockton. What is it per month?
It's $500 a month. We've done it for 18 months, and we extended it to January because of COVID-19. And what we found is that people spend money like how you and I and those watching spend money on food, on utilities, on getting their car fixed, and on emergencies. There's a class I took at Stanford called the Urban Underclass. And we did this game called Play Spent, which is this poverty simulation where it just showed how difficult and how expensive it was to be poor, and how one flat tire, one sick kid, when sickness yourself would be enough to knock you back and get you evicted with all those cascading consequences. And I remember reading, learning about that and now seeing it in real time, how the $500 has been such a lifeline. One quick story, a participant told me that she was laid off from her job because of COVID-19. And she's been applying for 2 months for unemployment. But luckily, the $500 was enough to pay for some of her bills, so that while waiting for 2 months for unemployment, through no fault of her own, she wasn't kicked out of her house, she didn't fall too far behind on bills, she didn't default on her credit cards, et cetera. And her story is one of thousands, because we know before COVID-19, about half the country didn't have enough money for one $400 emergency. And then one stat I learned today, Howard, that just shook me to my core is that the top 1/10 of 1% of Americans, or I know some of them, brilliant people, own as much wealth as 90% of the wealth of this country, which means the rest of Americans own 10% of wealth. Like that's, and again, I know some of these folks, I'm sure I know, and I'm sure they're no one's that brilliant. Like there's something wrong there. And I think a basic income is at one step of many we have to take, but I think it's an important step to allow people today on the ground to be able to pay for rent, pay for medicines, to take time off, because we don't guarantee sick leave. So you have all these folks who are essential workers who are told they have to work, who don't get paid time off, who if they take time off, they lose money, but who want to take time off, they don't want to spread COVID-19 to the people coming to on their places of businesses.
All right, so we've got 1 minute left, and I'm going to ask you a very unfair question, but I've got to ask, you're a registered Democrat, right? Who do you think Joe Biden should pick as his vice president?
Oh, 100%. It has to be Senator Kamala Harris.
100%.
100%. Senator Harris is the antidote. I think she's someone who believes in the rule of law. She's someone with executive experience. She's someone who's been vetted. And she's someone who can speak to this moment and has been. She's been on the vanguard of human rights her whole career. She performed the first same-sex marriage. She didn't prosecute someone for she was anti-death penalty before it was popular. She started back to work programs for folks come out the prison system. And even now she's leading on the Justice and Policing Act. She's legislated a form of basic income, a bill for 2 years. She used a tax code to get $500 a month to families making 100K or less. She's our senator in the great state of California and hopefully the next vice president of the United States.
Michael, thank you so much for being on the show. I learned a ton and I know our listeners will as well.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Stanford Pathfinders on SiriusXM. Listen to this and other episodes anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app or wherever you like to find your podcasts.